Good evening. In case you didn't hear me, good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. As all of you know here, quite simply, my role at the library, my role here is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when I'm successful, to make it levitate. Very briefly, I would like to encourage you all to become members of the library, to come afterwards and have Claude Lanzmann sign his book for you, 192 Books. Our independent bookstore is here as every live night. And as you know, for the last 2 or 3 years, I haven't been asking the various guests I invite to give me long biographies that then I will read. They are mostly very accomplished. What I do ask them now is to give me a 7-word description of their life. 7 words, a haiku, or if you want to be very modern, a tweet. And these are Claude Lanzmann's 7 words. He gave them to me in French, and I'll translate afterwards. Juif, trace, peur, mort, vie, honneur, amour, which translates as Jew, trace, fear, death, life, honor, love. Now, to provide us with a proper introduction, I'm going to ask Antonin Baudry, who is a cultural counselor. I'm reading this to get this absolutely right. Sometimes with these official titles, I can get things absolutely wrong. Antonin Baudry is a cultural counselor, permanent representative of French universities in the United States, Cultural Services Embassy of France. Antonin Baudry.
Good evening. Thank you, Paul. Paul is a very dangerous guy. Not only does he make the lions roar, but he even makes the French bureaucrats work. And I can testify as a typical French bureaucrat who, while working on this event with my dear friend Paul, received a total amount of 1,777 emails from him. Well, Paul, thank you for making the lions roar and my staff scream. But speaking of lions, we have here, in this arena, one of the fiercest lions on earth, Claude Lanzmann. We all heard Claude's 7 words. These are lion's words: life, death, fear, traces, honor. So, Paul is very tricky. He asked me to introduce the lion, which is, of course, dangerous. And this lion is a real carnivore. I can attest to that. And even if Claude Lanzmann is my best friend since the very first day we met several years ago, and I won't say the exact number because it's not a multiple of 7, so I'm not allowed by Paul to pronounce it. But after these several years, here is my declaration of love to Claude Lanzmann. And in order to be redeemed by Paul, who is literally obsessed by the number 7, I will tell you the 7 reasons why I love Claude Lanzmann. Because of his resilience, Claude's life is a fight against death and destiny. Everything he accomplishes is difficult. He's a lion who never climbs the small hills. He always attacks the highest mountains. We all can imagine how difficult making Shoah was, because of the subject of the film, of course, because of the absence of the people who are the center of the film, the 6 million Jews that were killed in the extermination camps, because of the 12 years of work it took to make the film with nearly no support. But it was necessary to do this film. It was necessary for Claude Lanzmann as an inner necessity, and it was necessary for the world. And this film is still and even more necessary today. We feel it in our flesh and blood as France is in mourning following the horrific tragedy in Toulouse. Another example of Claude's resilience is his ability to write, at the age of 84, a first book, The Patagonian Hare, which is a real masterpiece, and I insist on that. The Patagonian Hare is not a biography, or it is a biography if one considers that Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past is a biography. But both are much more. They are literary monuments. The second reason is Claude's humor, which becomes, in his universe, a wonderful weapon against death. The Patagonian Hare starts with the obsession of the guillotine and capital punishment. Claude imagines the way he would himself be guillotined. And suddenly, he realizes, quote, "I have no neck. I have often wondered, during nocturnal moments of acute bodily awareness spent anticipating the worst, where the blade would have to fall to behead me cleanly," unquote. And it's not Claude's lack of neck, but his enduring humor, which sends away any kind of guillotines, blades, and even death itself. The third reason is his capacity for survival and rebirth. Claude started as a resistance fighter because, as he says, that was the only way to survive for him, a young Jewish teenager in occupied France. When Shoah was launched, it sent waves across the globe. This was a shock. This was a tsunami. And for the world, it was the work of a lifetime. And of course, this work defines Claude. But with his book, The Patagonian Hare, he redefines himself once again. Nobody expected the author of Shoah to be also a great writer, a man defined by his quest for happiness, for pleasure, for life. The fourth reason is that Claude is a real poet. His presence here negates all dark prophecies, the so-called death of French culture, the so-called absence of French authors. Behind the pages of the Patagonian Hare, dictated to his friend Juliette Simon, we hear the echoes of another hunter who aims for happiness, the echoes of Stendhal dictating La Chartreuse de Parme in Civita Vecchia, the echoes of a man writing for posterity, a man that people will remember centuries later. And yes, people will remember Claude Lanzmann centuries later. I love Claude because he's a philosopher, a man who knows that he doesn't know the truth, a man who knows that there is no ultimate truth, that you have to dig and dig deeper and deeper, relentlessly. I love Claude because he's an adventurer. When I met Claude, I discovered we had two things in common: a passion for the great philosopher Leibniz, and a passion for flying military jets. That's the kind of adventurer he is. I never really understood whether Claude loves Leibniz or hates Leibniz, because Leibniz is the man who define the incompassibles. The incompassibles mean the things which are possible, but not possible together. You have to choose one or the other, and Claude always wants both. The seventh reason why I love Claude so much is because he will always be much younger than I am. Above and beyond everything, he's a 20 years old boy. I think that talking with him will be a unique experience for us all. The experience of talking with a man who has the strength of a lion, who has the knowledge and the wisdom of an old mountain, but who has the gaze of a child. Paul, thanks to you, Claude is here for the New Yorkers. Thank you, Paul. And please welcome Paul Oldendreber and the author of The Patagonian Hare, Claude Lanzmann. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Antonin, for having said it all. Look at me that way. You won't be blinded. You won't be blinded. We can bring them out down slightly. Claude Lanzmann, great pleasure to have you here tonight. Let's start with something that Antonin mentioned, many things which we will be talking about. But let's start with your obsession. I mean, you call it that way, your obsession with the guillotine. Your obsession, you say in the book, the guillotine more generally, capital punishment and the various methods of meeting our deaths has been the abiding obsession of my life. I'd like us to see an image, please, if we could. This image struck me when I was thinking and reading your book. This image was drawn by Victor Hugo. You probably know it. And I'd like you to develop a little bit where this obsession comes from and how it started to haunt you.
This is not the guillotine.
No, this is not more general. No, la pendaison. You know, there is, I don't know if there is a picture of Hugo of the guillotine. There is a picture I was looking for of a head that is floating in air, but I couldn't find it.
All right.
But talk to me a little bit about your obsession with a cut.
I will try.
Try.
I am not sure to be able, because among the seven words you asked me to choose, and Antonin Baudry enumerates them, this evening there is only one which wins over all the others which predominate. And forgive me, but it's because I am in front of you, it is fear. I am sweating with fear. It's absolutely true. And it is not very good, these are not very, very good conditions to have
But at least I started.
To have a deep discussion.
At least I started with something light.
I try to answer you. I say this in my book. It happened to me. I was very, very young when I was a maid took me to the cinema, and this was a film of called L'Affaire du Courrier de Lyon. And there is a man who you can see absolutely clearly the guillotine and the blade of the guillotine falling on the neck, and the man was innocent. And I was always scared very much, terrorized. I cannot, even now it's difficult for me to if I see in a book or in a newspaper an image of the guillotine. It's difficult for me to look at this image straightly. I have pain, it's difficult. And the real question is how death can be inflicted as a pain, as a punishment. How do you say capital punishment? It's a question I have no real answer for this, but I was haunted all my life by this question. There is a beautiful story which has not much to do with me, but it's a true story. During the French Revolution, during the reign of the Terror, one aristocrat was led to the guillotine in order to be beheaded. To say it. And he was on a cart with pulled by horses. But I don't know how this happened, but generally they had their hands tied in the back, but not he, not this man. I don't know by which generosity of the guards. And he was reading a book. And he didn't stop to read the book during all the way, a rather long way, till the place of the execution. And when he arrived just at the foot of the l'échafaud, of the guillotine, and when the hanker wanted to tie his hands, he said, "One second," and he just took the book like this, and he took the corner of the page, and he did this. And as if beheaded, he would go
The story is extraordinary, partly because it speaks of...
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah. Though. Speaks of a future, but you know, it's interestingly enough, it...
That's it. No, no, it would be the third degree Gestapo, your projector.
Let's bring it down one degree, if we could. But it's an interesting story also because it reminds me of something that was done in literature. Since we were looking at an image of Victor Hugo, you probably know Le Dernier Jour d'un Condamné,
yes.
A text that Hugo wrote when he was 29 years old, and where he has the main character, Le Condamné, the condemned man, right up to the moment that he comes on the échafaud. And Dostoevsky, who read the book, said that it was the most realist description ever written of capital punishment. Realist because in some way he had been like the stenograph, like a stenographer of human emotion. He had gotten into the brain of the condemned man. Now, the obsession with the guillotine is also woven in the book with your interest in the last glances.
In what?
The last, les derniers regards. Les regards. And I'd like you to say something about these last glances, the fact that in some way, le départ dès le début, you're leaving people.
Yes, of course. I was always haunted by this. And when I started to work on Shoah, I had not so many ideas at the moment, and I did not know how I would cope with such a subject. But there were some obsessions, personal obsessions that I had. So, you are right. The first moment of the arrival of Jews in an extermination camp, And the first moment was the last. It was exactly
collapsed into one. Yeah.
And it was the most very violent death, too. Anyhow, this is a parenthesis, but I think that there are only violent deaths, the so-called natural deaths. I don't believe in this. Death is always violent, even if you die in your bed. It is violent for the person who dies and violent for the people who remain.
So. At the very beginning of the book, you talk about torture and courage and cowardice. And you say, how many times have I wondered how I would react under torture? And every time my answer has been that I would have been incapable of taking my own life. Yes. And then you say the question of courage and cowardice is the scarlet thread that runs through this book, the thread that runs through my life.
Absolutely. I had to say this because if you write such a book, you have to be
clear
and sincere. And I think I was in this book. I am. And it is true. It was a real question. And sometimes it happens to me to think that what I did, because I took very serious risks, I put myself really in danger. And but I didn't face the real question. And the real question was precisely what you said. How would I behave? I don't know the concordance des temps, excuse me. If I had been caught by the Germans and tortured, and the tortures of the Gestapo were something very, very serious. They didn't take pictures. It was not Abu Ghraib. There are people who are really heroes, and I knew some of them, who being, nobody can predict, but who didn't want to go through this test. Will it be possible for me to stand the torture without talking? They were not sure and they killed themselves before. I am absolutely not sure I would have had the real courage to do this. It is the reason why, if I am clear with me and sincere, all what I have done is amateurism. I don't know how you say this in English. Amateurism. It
just
exists.
That way. Yeah. Mm.
Alors, there is nothing to be proud of.
Something to be ashamed of?
Maybe it's going a little bit too far, but why not? Why not? I accept. Because this is a real test. And I talk in this book about the so-called, it was a, Sartre liked very much this expression, le courage militaire, the military courage. The people who killed immediately themselves. And but it is, you are right, it is a red thread in this book all along. Because this was a this is at the core of a film like Shoah, for instance. The whole question of the people of the the Jews of the Sonderkommando who were working between brackets, because it was not a work, at the last stage of the destruction process of the, and I choose only these people because they had been the only witnesses of the death of the Jewish people, with the killers, of course, because they used to work in the crematorium and with the corpses and to watch the people when they undress themselves before going under the whips inside the gas chambers. And there are people who ask absolutely obscene questions. Why did they accept it? Why didn't they commit suicide, precisely?
Well, you have passages in this book, yes, where you say the will to life.
I consider that these people, these Jews of the Sonderkommando, most of them, were very decent, honest, good men. They were only men, there were no women. They were simple, intelligent, good, but they privileged life, the value of life, of their own life, because there is only life. There is a film which has been shot about me 2 years ago in France for the French television. They asked me, I was asked, do you have a title for this film? And I took as a title one of the sentences of a man of the Sonderkommando. I think it was Yael Yankovsky, or Salman Levental.
Levental.
Salman Levental. Before the uprising of the Sonderkommando in October 1944, in Auschwitz, Birkenau, they buried in the mud around the commando, they buried what they had written day after day, the chronicle of the hell, of the inferno. One of them wrote, it is Salman Levental, one wants to live because everybody lives. One wants to live because there is only life. And it is a title I have asked to the people who made this film about me. There is only life.
I mean, the lines here read, but it is Salman Levental, the admirable Froissart of the Sonderkommando, who in his upright handwriting best answered the obscene question. The truth is, he wrote, is that you want to live at any cost. You want to live because you are alive, because the whole world is alive. There is nothing but life. No, my brothers, you are not the cadets of Saumur Cavalry School in 1940, defending the bridges of the Loire, prepared to die in the Hegelian manner for honor and the war of consciousness. No, you hated death, and in its kingdom, you have sanctified life absolutely.
Yes, in the kingdom of death.
You were talking a minute ago about the honesty that you were striving towards.
Yes.
This book, it's a small question, but you can give a big answer. This book was dictated.
You ask me why,
yes,
did I dictate?
This book was dictated.
Yes.
I'm wondering what the process of dictation versus the process of writing.
I will try, but one has to give a topographical explanation.
Okay.
I was not walking like in a romantic film, and dictating the thing non-stop. No, no, it was not like
so,
this.
So tell me.
I was sitting at your place. Here was a table. On the table there was a computer. And near the computer there was a second screen, larger, connected with the computer. And I was sitting here, and Juliette Simon, to whom I dictated the book, was sitting there. We were sitting next to each other. And between the first page of this book and the second one, 1 year passed. One year elapsed. Yes. Because I was not in a hurry to. And I hesitated. I would not. I was.
No, because one is struck in the book by various moments where you say, but I'm discovering something new. I digress.
I try to explain you. I had other things to do. I had to deal with my films, with Les Temps Modernes. I am the director of this magazine created by Jean-Paul Sartre. And life, simply life, requires time for me anyhow. It's a very simple fact to live. And the requisites of life for me, okay, takes me a lot of time, and I think it is worthwhile. But she was very patient, because sometimes I stopped for 1 minute, 2 minutes, 1 hour, 6 hours, or several days.
And she was still sitting there?
No, because in order to go on, I have to be sure that it is perfect. I have to have my back against
the wall.
The wall of the perfection. I can't go on.
You know, we'll come back to that later, but I think this image of being patient and having one's back on the wall is something that we might talk about when we talk about your methods in Shoah. It's okay. Very interesting.
Don't be too intelligent, please.
Let's talk for a moment.
I did not finish to explain you how I dictated this book. I didn't make a plan, you know. I did not know where I was going.
And you did not.
There are many things in this book. I did not know that I would integrate them in the book. Things which are very personal and very private. But the more I was writing or dictating, it is exactly the same for me. I dictated many things during my life. There is another book of me which just was released in France, a book of articles I wrote or I dictated during my life. It was nothing new for me to dictate, but I don't walk like this. I am sitting, and the sea. I was offered. I never learned to type, you know, and I was offered a computer after Shoah, and I discovered the marvelous possibilities of this tool. And what was important for me is to see immediately my thoughts inscribed on the screen, objectively. You know. I was very often fed up with my own handwriting. And there is a sentence of Jean-Paul Sartre.
Of the
said,
stickiness, right?
What?
He talks about the stickiness.
My own writing, when I am anguished, like now, when I am anguished or when I am in fear, which happens very often, or when I am tense or tired, my own writing changes. Sartre wrote this about himself, that he was disgusted with his own handwriting, which was really very beautiful anyhow. He says in French, gluante de tous mes sucs. Translate this, please.
I evoked the notion of stickiness, of, it's more or less that.
Okay, alors, it was beautiful for me to see what I dictated immediately printed, like in a book. But I was, since I did not learn to type, I was using the computer in a too slow manner. I had the objectivation of my thoughts, but I lost the momentum because I was like a cop in the first time they type with one finger. Today they master completely the computer, the people of the police. They learn this. It is the reason why Juliette Simon, she gave me her hands, her fingers. And she has a wonderful presence, inspiring. And it was... And the more I wrote, the more I dictated, as you wish. I prefer to say I wrote because it is the same. The more I had pleasure to write this book, and I decided that many things which I didn't plan to integrate should be in the book.
Well, maybe it's natural for me to ask you to give me one example of something that came about that you didn't...
The death of my sister, for instance. The suicide of my sister. It is a very difficult chapter because I was obliged to tell her life. She committed suicide at the age of 36 to gather all this and to write a complete chapter only about my sister, her life and her death. I didn't foresee this, but I was pushed to do it.
Did you foresee writing about the discovery you made about...
What?
Did you foresee writing about the discovery you made about your father?
Which discovery?
The discovery that he too was in La Résistance.
Did I foresee what? This?
Yes, that you would write about it, because it's something that you discovered.
Yes, but I think it was absolutely important to relate this. Maybe I did not foresee, but it was sure that... I would have to write about this.
At one moment in the book, you talk about your relationship with your father, and you talk about not betraying your father. And you have a line which is quite extraordinary from Camus, where you say, "Like Albert Camus, who condemned the blind terrorism of which his mother might have been a victim during the war in Algeria, saying, 'I believe in justice, but I will defend my mother before justice.'"
Yes.
I too instinctively chose my loyalty to my father over my loyalty to the party, which refused to keep its words.
The party wants us to say that it's a communist party.
How were they about to betray him?
How?
Were they about to betray him?
If I had obeyed to the communist party, to the orders they gave me, it would have been a real betrayal of my father, because there was an agreement between the two resistance movements, between the communists and between the organization of my father, the Gaullist one. And there was a real deal, a real agreement. I was almost decorated by the Communist Party. They were so happy. Because they had a real problem. The problem of the communists during the war was to get weapons. And there was only one way for them to get weapons. It was to take the weapons on the enemy to kill Germans. I wrote, I don't know if it's fair from me to talk about this now, but I know that Richard Brody is not far from here. And I thank you for your beautiful article in the New Yorker. But you made just a mistake. And it is not your fault. You made songs and compliments to the translator. But it is a mistake because the translator of this book is not Mr. Frank White. I had to revise line after line his translation because it was full of horrible mistakes, and you will see why I talk about this. And in the British publisher of this book, it is the same translation, but the British publisher acknowledged black and white on the second page of the credits of the book that I was the one who revised the book last summer for 3 months, line after line. This Mr. Frank Wine had no literary knowledge and no historical knowledge, which is even more grave. And I come back to my... But it's not your fault, Mr. Brody. Because now the translation is good. Alors, I tell you why. I write in the book that the communists were excluded of the parachutage of weapons given to the French resistance by the Allied forces, by the British and the Americans. And that these weapons were given only to the Gaullist resistance, General de Gaulle. Mr. Frank Wine, before the revision by me, Mr. Frank Wine translated in the following way. The communists were excluded of the parachute and so on, which were given only to the French resistance, as if the communists were not French, you know. And it is terrible because the last 70 years are a tsunami with the fall of the of the communism of the Soviet Union and so on, of the Berlin Wall. These people know nothing anymore. It has been the core of our lives, but and it is a very small example. And Farrar, Strauss and Giroux promised me to acknowledge, if there is another edition of this book, to acknowledge that
to come back
the
to
revision
your,
had been made to, by me.
To come back to your father, he prepared you at every given moment for the...
He was a very pessimist man, and he was sure that the worst would arrive.
How this is a question I've been wondering, is how early on did you find out about the camps?
If you want the most honest answer.
I do.
Truly, when I started my work on Shoah, before I had just a result, an abstraction, 6 million died, but it is nothing, it's just a figure. Yes, it is the honest answer.
So
the Jews seem, because they are Jews, that they have the inner knowledge ready. It's not true at all. One has to work and show up to make sure it would really work.
So to come back once more to your father was pessimistic and knew that the Shoah was coming. What did he...
He did not know that the Shoah was coming because it was impossible really to foresee such an horror. But he knew that it would be horrible, surely. The very first day of the defeat of France, when there was a famous speech of the Marshal Pétain saying that he had asked for a ceasefire to the Germans. I was not very old. I was, it was in 1940. How old was I?
15.
Already? Yes.
Maybe 14.
More 14 than 15, yes. Because I was born very late in 25. Somebody gave me a dog, a beautiful small dog, un chien danois, Danish. And I loved him very much. He was 3 months old. And my father, having heard the speech of the Marshal Pétain, took me aside and told me, we cannot keep your dog. I said, why? He told me, we have to, starting now, we have to live unseen. We cannot be seen. And your dog will become a very remarkable dog. They're beautiful, very high. And I started to scream, to refuse, but okay, he gave the dog to a veterinarian, who was probably drunk, I don't know, but he killed the dog. It was a moment, all the animals have to get an injection to survive, to live. He made a mistake. But maybe my father told him to kill the dog because the dog would grow up very high and they need a lot of meat, these dogs. And he thought that this would be very difficult. Maybe, I don't know. But this question, you know, the Jews are even at the door of the gas chamber. We have many scenes like this in the Shoah. They refuse to, even if they had the evidence in front of their eyes, they refused. And Philip Müller, who is one of the main protagonists of Shoah, this beautiful sentence, who wants to live is condemned to hope. At the very door of the gas chamber when the Germans told the Jews to undress, we will clean you. Clean and not kill, but it was the Jews believed it. Alors, to foresee such an horror was impossible. And your question, when did I know? I knew when I started to work.
In your adolescence, early adult life, one book had an incredible power over you. Réflexion sur la question juive. And you talk about it quite early on in the book. You say, with every line, book published in 1946, with every line, I felt alive again. Or, to be more precise, I felt I had been given permission, and in italics, to live. Later, I came to the description of what Sartre calls the Jewish innocenticity, and in it I suddenly found a portrait perfectly depicting myself.
It's true, yeah. It's true, there are two things which remain unequaled in this book. It is a portrayal of the anti-Semite that written by Sartre. It's wonderful. It has not even today one wrinkle. The portrayal of the anti-Semitic passion, because it is a passion.
A passion.
Passion. La passion anti-Semite. And the description of the what he called the inauthentic behavior of the Jews. Many Jews are like this. I was like this.
How so?
Because I was a child. Conformist, like most of the child, or the children, pardon.
Embarrassed by going shopping for shoes with your mother.
Oh, this is epitome. This is the absolute paradigmatic example of inauthentic. Conduct, inauthentic behavior. I didn't see my mother for because my parents were separated and I didn't see my mother for between 1938 and 1943, where I made a trip to Paris with false papers, with a false identity. I was 4 years without seeing my mother. And she spent the whole war in Paris with false papers, false identity cards, even the special paper in order to be able to eat, to buy food in the shops. Okay, but she was fearless. She looked extremely Jewish. Golda Meir, compared to my mother, is a pure blonde Aryan. And she stuttered too. She stuttered because when she came to France at the age of 3 months, her parents put a pillow on her to forbid her to scream, passing the frontier secretly. And she stuttered all her life, except when she was angry. Why do I tell you this?
The inauthentic inner feeling. When going, I was just evoking that moment you described.
Okay. And I arrived from province, from the mountains of Auvergne, with wooden shoes. Everybody had wooden shoes. But my wooden shoes were very ugly, very provincial. And she decided that I should wear beautiful wooden shoes. And she took me in a big shop, which was Jewish before before the war, which had been Aryanized. And she, like me, Antonin talked very well about this. She could not choose. I cannot choose. To choose is to kill. And it is the reason why I make such long films. Probably. And she asked for to the seller, okay, show me a pair of shoes for my son, okay, one pair, two pairs, three pairs, four pairs. There was a mountain of boxes of shoes, and she was unable to choose, and the people started to gather around us with mean faces, and I thought we will be caught. We will be caught. She was completely unconscious. And, okay, I did not betray my father, but I escaped my mother because I was full of fear that I ran. I left her alone with the mountains of shoes. Nothing to be proud of.
And okay. you were also worried by her looks, by the way she looked.
she was a beauty. She was very beautiful. Now I have pictures of her in my home in Paris, and I see how beautiful she is. She was, but she had a Jewish type, and I was an unauthentic Jew. Inauthentic Jew, and full of fear. The fear, I have still the fear in me. This is not...
You recount in your book the period of Saint-Germain and the life you were living at that moment and the kinds of writers... Of writers and intellectuals you were meeting. Of course, we'll come to Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre, but there were others. There was Francis Ponge, there was Éluard, there were all kinds of writers.
Yes.
And when you look back retrospectively now, so many years back, and you look at that period, which in our mind is now extremely, I mean, it's iconic, In our mind, it's iconic. It's something that we can
iconic.
Who emerges from those writers that is important to you, leaving aside Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir?
Who emerged? Excuse me. There were great poets, no? Edouard was a great poet. Aragon too. Francis Ponge too. Jean Cocteau. My mother was in love with the feet of Cocteau because they were very small. And she found that my own feet were ugly and bête, comment dit-on, bête, and stupid. She was a strange woman. But she was very strong, she was a genius. She was very courageous. She held the three times in front of the Gestapo. And there was pictures of Hermann Göring at the wall. And she told to the people of the Gestapo, look at your Göring, he looks more Jewish than me. She did it.
During that same period, one of your main occupations was stealing books.
Was?
Stealing books. You enjoyed, no. But you enjoyed, but you enjoyed stealing books and
no,
certain books in particular.
It's complicated.
It's not enjoyed, but Jean Hippolyte, for instance.
Yes.
It struck me that you should. Steal a book which was a commentary on Hegel.
It is complex. It is complicated.
Maybe I shouldn't have said you enjoyed stealing books, but in the memoir you do write about
to steal books of philosophy, very difficult books. It's not exactly the usual stealing. It was a fashion. It's because we read Sartre at this time. Novels of Sartre. And we all admire Sartre very much. Les chemins de la liberté, the pathways of freedom. And in Les chemins de la liberté, there are people who steal books. And it was a way to testify our admiration for Sartre. But I became a very good stealer, book stealer. One can say
thief.
And I sold even books with several volumes. How do you say this?
And you sometimes went to meet the writers of the books.
Okay,
in the case of Hippolyte, he wrote you a letter.
And Hippolyte, Jean Hippolyte, was a famous philosopher, condisciple of Jean-Paul Sartre at the École Normale Supérieure, and he was a specialist of Hegel. And of course, we admired very much Hegel because he was a great philosopher, in spite of the fact that he was a German. But many great philosophers were German. And it is the reason why I went to Germany
two years
after the end of the war, because Germany, strange to say, but it is the truth, remains the home, the patrie, the Heimat of philosophy.
The homeland.
For us.
The homeland.
Homeland of philosophy. Even today, when I go to Berlin, there is it's a city I like very much. There is a very small and charming cemetery in the middle of Berlin. And in this cemetery, you have the tomb of Hegel, of Frau Hegel, Madame Hegel, and the tomb of another great German philosopher, Fichte. And I go there sometimes. It's a cemetery is beautiful, and it's a way to pay tribute to philosophy.
And
but I go also along the Landwehr Canal, where the body of Rosa Luxemburg, after she had been assassinated by the Nazi, was thrown her corpse. This I go almost every time.
When you went to Berlin, you went to teach a class, and I'm
no, not in Tübingen, in Berlin. I was lector in the Freie Universität Berlin.
And you taught a class on Jean-Paul Sartre and Stendhal.
Pardon?
You taught a class on Jean-Paul Sartre and Stendhal.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, how did these two figures find themselves together?
Well, it will be difficult to explain, but being on nothingness, it's the first great book of philosophy written by Sartre, which appeared in 1943, as a matter of fact. He has a description on what he called la mauvaise foi.
Bad faith.
Bad faith. How, for instance, a man succeeds to seduce a woman. He wants to make love with her, but he climbs towards the spirituality, the sky. And if you read Le Rouge et le Noir, black, how do we say in English? Black
and red. Red and the black, the red and the scarlet.
Of Stendhal, the real question is how Madame de Renal and Julien Sorel can everything separate them, how they, comment ils se rejoignent, how they reach
come together,
each other.
Reach it.
And I made a mixture of Sartre and Stendhal, very coherent. Coherent. I was, my students like this, liked it very much. The students, the men were all older than me, because they came back from the war prisoners camps. The girls at the normal age. But I paid my German taxes, even church tax, Kirchensteuer. I was very proud of this.
Some years later, you went for your first trip to Israel.
Yes.
And you met Ben Gurion. And in Israel, the seeds of Shoah formed themselves.
Pardon?
The seeds of Shoah formed themselves. You were told by a state official that you should make a film on the Shoah.
Ah, yes, but it was not in 1952.
Right.
It was much later. After I made my first film, Pourquoi Israel? Israel, why? No, but I was not synchron with this story because in 1948 I was not in Israel. I was in Berlin. And during the blockus of Berlin, during the airlift, and I was fascinated by the planes, the flying fortress. And it's much later that... yes, I forget to say that in 1952, when I went to Israel for the first time, I discovered, because there is one thing which is false in the... not true in the reflection sur la question juive de Sartre. Two things are very bright, the portrayal of the anti-Semite and the description of the inauthentic behaviors of the Jews. But one thing is false. He said that the Jews are a creation of the anti-Semite. If there wouldn't be anti-Semites, there would be If there would not be anti-Semites, there would not be Jews. And I discovered when I reached Israel that all this was false. I discovered that there was a Jewish people. And it was
and
a Sartre, great shock.
And Sartre was very welcoming.
Yes, because he was open. One could talk.
And you went on trips with him to Israel?
Much later, sir. Much later.
But Sartre was very interested in your trips to Israel and actually in your disproving him, in you telling him that he was wrong.
Yes, I told him. Yeah. And he admitted.
And in 19, after you did Why Israel, and you went back again to Israel in 1973, you met Gershom Scholem, you met the state official, and that is where the seed of Shoah happened.
Ah, yes, yes. Shoah is a work of, comment dit-on, œuvre de commande. I was
ordered. It was a.
I did not decide to cope with this subject. I was asked by an Israeli friend, very important.
Aluf Hareven, I think, Director General of the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, suggested to you that you make a film on Shoah. He said a film that is Shoah. But you then came up with the name of Shoah. You came up with the word and gave the Holocaust another name.
Yes, I worked 12 years to make Shoah, day after day. It was really a war. Every film is a war, but Shoah was a total war in every respect. Could you repeat me your question?
I'm not sure what the question was.
Your question.
I don't remember where I left it off. I was saying that this was in, well, you were saying it is an œuvre de commande. You worked on it for 12 years. And
yes.
Now I'm stumped by you. Shoah. You say that this film differs from all others because it will focus on what was missing: the gas chambers, death in the gas chambers, from which returned to.
Excuse me. You are too fast. When I was offered to do this film.
You didn't know.
I did not know. I had to find my subject, the core of the film. And it was not so easy to find. I remember reading books and books and books on the archives, written archive material. And trying to make charts and so on. It was maybe useful, but a little bit stupid. And I found my subject after almost 2 years of war. And my subject, I discovered that Shoah should not be a film about survival. It is by no means a film about survival. It is a film about death, about the radicality of death in the gas chamber. And when I convinced myself about this, of course, it gave me the keys to make the film. It doesn't mean that it was easy. It was not easy at all. But it is the reason why I decided that there should be Germans in the film. There should be perpetrators, killers, in spite of all the difficulties and dangers it represented. But this is what is the film about. Because
I'd like to
in the second era of Shoah, it is the core of the second era, the difference between a concentration camp and an extermination camp. It's not at all the same. Everybody makes the confusion. But the survivors don't like me very much and don't like, they hate very often Shoah, because they are not inside Shoah. Shoah is not a film about survival. It's a film about death. And the Jewish protagonists of Shoah, they're all members of the Sonderkommando. I choose them because they could testify for the last moments of the Jewish people. They never say I, they never explain how they succeeded to escape, not to survive. They are not survivors, they are, I call them in French, revenants. They are like ghosts, they come from the threshold of the crematorium, or even of the gas chamber, for Philip Müller. And they were interested only in the fate of the people as a whole, not about their own story. And I was not interested myself.
I want us to look at clip number two, if we could.
Das ganze Terrain war abgezäumt von SS-Waffen. Die Hunde bellten. Maschinengewehre waren da. Jeder von denen hat gezweifelt. Die polnischen Juden hauptsächlich. Wahrscheinlich ahnten sie auch, dass da etwa nicht stimmt. Aber niemand von denen könnte nicht einmal in den kleinsten vorstellen, dass er vielleicht in 3-4 Stunden in Asche verwandelt wird. Wenn Sie in den Auskleideraum gekommen sind, haben Sie da gesehen, dass der Auskleideraum hat ausgesehen wie ein internationales Informationszentrum. Auf die Wänden waren angebracht Haken und auf jeden Haken war eine Nummer. Und unter den Haken waren Bänke aus Holz, damit sich die Menschen ausziehen können, bequemer, wie sie sagten. Und jetzt auf den vielen Säulen, die stürzten durch diese unterirdische Auskleideraum, befanden sich viele Plakaten, auch in vielen Sprachen angebracht. Rein ist fein. Eine Laus, dein Tod. Wasche dich. Zum Desinfektionsraum. Viele solche Schilder und Plakaten, deren Aufgabe es doch war, nur die Menschen in den Gaskammern dann ausgezogen hereinlocken. Und links gegenüber war die Gaskammer. Mit einer massiven Tür ausgestattet.
It's 3000 people died together. Men, women, children. Philip Müller says this beautifully, but it was difficult to shoot. It was so cold, the camera was frozen.
There's a line by Shoshana Feldman, where she says, Shoah is a film made exclusively of testimonies.
Made what?
Exclusively of testimonies. Mm. It conducts its interviews and takes its pictures in the present. Rather than a simple view about the past, the film offers a disorienting vision of the present, a compelling, profound, and surprising insight into the complexity of the relation between history and witnessing.
Okay, she wrote a beautiful piece, yes, which I translated myself in print. 100 pages. Better translation than Frank White.
This relationship between witnessing and history.
Listen, there are no corpses in Shoah. There is no one single corpse. Why? Because there were no corpses in the extermination camp. The people died and were burned immediately on the ashes, thrown into lakes, river, wind. Shoah is not... I wrote to Mr. Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran. He says that this never existed. It is a creation of the Jews and of the Zionists. And I told him, if you want to see Shoah as a proof that the extermination actually took place, you are very wrong. Shoah is by no means a proof. There are no corpses. Many people want corpses, you know. But precisely, it is the lack of corpses which is the truth. You have in the cemeteries in France, for instance, still you have this. You have many tombs completely empty with a picture on the tomb of a woman, a man, or even a child with a written legend or mention, killed in Auschwitz in 1942 or 1943. But there are no corpses, no bones, no nothing. I don't know if it is, if I answer to your question about relationship between history
and witnessing.
Witnessing, but it has always been the case, no? and witnessing.
Everybody
today said, ah, la la, what will happen? The last witness are dying or disappearing. But they are not witnesses, excuse me. There is no one single witness but of what happened inside a gas chamber. Nobody returned alive from a gas chamber.
Yet one of the ways in which you manage to tell the story is through some witnesses in the present time who reenact. I mean, I know one of the passages in Shoah that is most meaningful to you.
The what?
One of the passages that is most meaningful to you is the Baba.
Yes.
And you have him quite painfully. I would like us to see it. I'm sure many people have seen it. But you very painfully have him reenact his moment.
Because you have to imagine how difficult it is for such a man, for such a people, to relate in front of a camera, in front of a cinema team, what they went through, what they did, cutting the hair of the Jewish woman inside the gas chamber. It's horrible. It is one of the reasons I discovered during my work that for the Jewish protagonists of the film, I had to know as much as possible before shooting in order to be able to help them. And Abraham Bomba, the barber of Treblinka, was more and more anxious when the time that when he should relate this horrible story approached. And I was myself very anxious too.
And yet you push him to the wall. You push him as far
First of all, I had suddenly the idea to film this in a hairdressing salon. Why? Because he could make the gesture. And of course, it couldn't be a hairdressing salon for women. It would have been absolutely obscene. Try to imagine this. There were always, during the making of Shoah, ethical questions, which were in the same moment, aesthetical, no difference. And I proposed him my idea, and he liked it. Okay, he found himself the hairdressing salon. He was not a barber anymore, he was retired, but he had still the yellow dress. He was a barber in a Grand Central Station before going to Israel, on the underground of a Grand Central Station here in New York. And when he starts to talk, there are several moments. It's a very complicated, complex scene. He starts to talk in a completely neutral voice, objective voice, as if it did not happen to him. And he tries to escape every question related to him. And I had to stop him and to tell him, no, Abraham, it doesn't go like this. And there is a second moment in the scene where he answers to my question, what did he feel when he saw arriving in the gas chamber where he was waiting for the woman with 16 other barbers, when he saw them arriving naked, completely, with the children, And he had a beautiful answer. You saw to have a feeling over there, living day and night with such a procedure with, among corpses and so on. Your feeling disappeared. You were dead with the feeling. And it is at this very moment that he breaks. Suddenly the feelings come back full force.
Let's look at clip three if we could.
Well, we have to do the job to get rid of the hair. Like I mentioned that, the Germans, they needed the hair for their purposes.
But I have asked you and we didn't answer, what was your impression the first time you saw arriving this naked woman with children? What did you feel?
I tell you something, to have a feeling over there was very hard to feel anything or to have a feeling. Because working there day and night between their people, between their bodies, men and women, your feeling disappeared. You were dead with your feeling. You had no feeling at all. And matter of fact, I want to tell you something what it happened. At the gas chamber, when I was chosen in over there to work as a barber, some of women that came in from a transport from my town, from Częstochowa. And from the women, from the number of women, I know a lot of people.
You knew them?
I know them. I live with them in my town. I live with them in my street. And I was, some of them, they were my close friends. And when they saw me, all of them started hugging me. Abe, this and that, what are you doing here? What's going to happen with us? What could you tell them? What could you tell a friend of mine? He worked as a barber. He was also a good barber in my hometown. When his wife and his sister came into the guest chamber,
you must go. You have to.
Can't do it. It's too hard.
Please. We have to do it. You know it. Have to do it. I know it's very hard. I know and I apologize.
Keep me along with that, please.
Please, let's go.
I told you today it's going to be very hard.
I
taken in with bags. That was transported to Germany. And as I'm in part, you must have to dieselbe Sache auf der US, auf der Sonne, den, in Deutschland durch. Okay, go ahead.
On dit il brotherly sin. I am his brother. And he knew it. It is not, I don't torture him, not at all. It is not a sadistic sin. He wanted to.
By saying this, you're answering your critics.
Pardon?
By saying what you just said, you're answering your critics. Some critics have felt that in these moments you pushed people too much.
There are stupid people, yes. It happened. I didn't push him. He was very, very grateful to me after this very day. And when the film was released, I saw him several times. He was a great man. I admired him very much. But it was... As Marcelo Fuld said rightly, you cannot make a film like Shoah and respect the rules of fairness of a cricket player of Eton. It's a different world.
When you say in closing, when you say that he was your brother, one of the concepts that comes up towards the end of your autobiography is the notion of incarnation.
It is incarnation. The tears of Bomba are incarnation. The tears of Bomba are the seal of truth. They are more precious than blood. Shoah is an experience. It is a real incarnation. Not only him, but
what does that mean?
What?
What does that mean?
Incarnation. It means it's the only possible resurrection. You cannot see this and. Without you épouse, je ne sais pas comment on dit.
You espouse, you fill.
Yes. It's a problem for you that it is an incarnation?
No.
It's really, it is.
No, it's not a problem at all. I want to understand better. Because you've been asked and you've said Shoah in one word is about incarnation.
Yes. What do you want that I add? It's very clear, no? When I say to you it is... Yeah. The seal of truth. I think it is. It's not a man with a tie telling a souvenir. It's much stronger than any souvenir. Souvenirs are completely weak. It is not souvenir. He relives.
I mean, you
he lives again.
But you put them in the in that situation of reliving.
Yes, but he agreed to this. Don't forget that I spent 2 days on one night with him, 2 or 3 years before the actual shooting, in the mountains upstate New York. I had no camera, I had no tape recorder, hardly a pen, and I listened at him for 2 days on one night, and I told him, I asked him if he would agree to appear in this film. He said yes. I told him I cannot tell you when. I am not even sure that the film will ever exist. And I lost him because when I shot with him, he was living in Israel, not anymore in the United States. But
you tracked him down.
I had to, yes. But I wanted, I knew in advance, thanks to these 2 days, as much as possible of him. But I didn't foresee the tears. This came because of the camera, because of the actual shooting. It was very important for the incarnation. And with this camera, I had to reload every 11 minutes. And it's a complicated scene. And I felt during the shooting that something was, a tension was climbing. There was a tension. I thought that something could happen. I did not know
what,
when, and I was not sure. But there is, I looked behind the camera, there is a counter. How do you say a counter?
Timer.
Timer? A counter. One can read how many meters of film remain. A virgin film, and remained 5 or 6 minutes, I don't remember exactly. It is, in one way, it is much. But I obeyed to an intuition, and I said to my cameraman very slowly, coup, we cut and we reload immediately. There were des magasins, comment dit-on?
Shops.
Non, non, pas chaud.
Pas d'importance, continuez.
Non, mais si, y a, ok, oui. We put a new
film.
A new film, 11 minutes. On the. He broke at the very moment where I wouldn't have, there wouldn't remain film in the camera if I had not obeyed to my intuition and changed it. I could not have asked him, please cry again. No, this is what is incarnation. It is not theater, sir.
The title of the book.
The what?
The title of the book. To end with the title of the book is another form of incarnation.
It is what?
The title of the book,
yes.
Le titre du livre, yes. Is another form of incarnation.
It is an incarnation. Incarnation is my only problem. One has to, the question is very simple. Is the world a decor or not? If the world is a decor, when you are in a very fast train, the world is a decor, you don't see anything. Okay? But incarnation happens in this book at several moments. And it happened in Shoah most of the time. And... when I was in Patagonia, for instance, I was talking to myself because I was happy to be in Patagonia. I was alone. I was 70. And in the far south of Argentina. And I rented a car and I started to drive northwest towards the border of Chile. I wanted to see les glaciers, the beautiful glacier, Perito Moreno and so on. All right, but there was a beautiful, immense sky, and I was talking to myself. This happens rather often in my life. I talk to me. And I was telling to myself, please, you are in Patagonia, you should explode with joy. I was happy to be in Patagonia, but I did not explode. Patagonia remained a decor. I saw even llamas from the fur, you know. It's really Patagonia. Okay. Patagonia remained a decor. And at the very end of the day, when I left the main road, the asphalt road, I had seen 90 kilometers to drive on a bad, very bad road, on a piste. And suddenly I saw a hare crossing in front of my headlights. And I did everything I could in order not to kill the hare. And I succeeded. I did not kill him. But my heart exploded. I was suddenly in Patagonia. And I say this in the book, Patagonia and me and I, we were true together. This is what is incarnation.
Thank you very much.
Elle est née d'aujourd'hui dans le cœur d'un garçon. Sous le ciel de Paris marchent les amoureux. Leur bonheur se construit sur un air fait pour eux. Sous le pont de Bercy, un philosophe assis, deux musiciens, quelques badauds, puis des gens par milliers. Sous le ciel de Paris jusqu'au soir vont chanter. L'hymne d'un peuple épris de sa vieille cité. Que reste-t-il de nos amours? Que reste-t-il de ces beaux jours? Une photo, vieille photo de ma jeunesse. Que reste-t-il des billets doux, des mois d'avril, des rendez-vous, un souvenir qui me poursuit sans cesse. Bonheur fané, cheveux au vent, baisers volés, rêves. Que reste-t-il de tout cela? Dites-le-moi. Un petit village, un vieux clocher, un paysage si bien caché, et dans un nuage, le cher visage de mon passé. Quand je la prends dans mes bras, qu'elle parle tout bas, je vois la vie en moi.